If you've been feeling overwhelmed, disconnected, or a little unsure of where hope lives for you right now, today's conversation is for you because I am joined by a very special guest, Dr. Diane Dreher. She's a positive psychology coach, but more importantly, she's a researcher on the topic of hope and also how nature affects your well-being. She's also the author of Pathways to Inner Peace, and she's someone who beautifully bridges the science, spirituality, and storytelling of our nervous system and how nature affects us. And she reminds us that tending to hope is an active practice, and nature can be the tool to unlock it. I want 2026 to be the most grounded, most creative, most peaceful, most joyful year for us. And I hope this conversation gets us one step towards it. Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants. Hey, plant friends, it's Maria. If you're new here, I'm the host and your new best plant friend. If you're a returning listener, welcome home. I'm so happy to have you with us. I just wanted to give you a quick reminder before we dive into this episode with Diane that we have already done part one of our two-part experience for Growing Joy in 2026. But if this episode resonates with you, I can't recommend grabbing the second part, the second class of our Growing Joy in 2026 series enough. On February 15th, our community is going to gather together and we are going to explore how we can make 2026 the most joyful, the most rooted, the most grounded year yet, no matter what chaos comes into our life. I want everyone in our community to look back on December 2026, look back on the year and say, wow, this year felt different. This year felt amazing. So if you're interested, you can go to growingjoywithmaria.com/2026 and sign up for that second part of our Growing Joy in 2026 experience. And without further ado, here is a wonderful and free episode that gives you so much inspiration and tactical things that you can immediately start doing after you are done listening to this episode, or maybe even while you're listening to this episode. I hope it helps. Joy. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Maria. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. So, what has your relationship with nature looked like your whole life? What kind of plant lady are you?
Oh my gosh. My grandfather was a gardener. So he used to carry me on his shoulders and we'd go look at his tomato plants and he'd bring one in ripe, you know, warm, and we'd eat it in the kitchen. So I've loved gardening all my life, which has been very difficult because my father was an Air Force pilot. And every time I planted a garden, he'd get transferred and we'd move away. So now have a garden in my yard in Northern California. And actually, I just planted snow peas because we can plant them at this time of year. And they're already sprouting, which is wonderful. It's a little too early for tomatoes and zucchini and those, but winter vegetables work really well. And it's so much fun to see things growing.
It's so nice. And I recently moved to Florida from New York. And I do have to say, having a longer gardening season is really nice. You know, you don't get that crazy, like, caged animal feeling come March and April, you know, in New York when you're just like dying to get outside.
Right, exactly. I mean, we can grow things inside, but there's something about touching the earth and being in touch with nature on that level that really makes a difference to me.
And you're not a plant lady by profession. So what do you do and what is your area of expertise in?
Well, that's a great question. I have a PhD in Renaissance English literature. I've taught Renaissance literature and creative writing at Santa Clara University. I then went back to school to get a master's degree in counseling because my students were always telling me their problems. And I thought, well, how can I help them? So now I'm a professor emeritus. I do research on hope and write books. I wrote a book called Inner Gardening, actually, about how gardens inspired people in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance as a spiritual practice, actually. They'd go out and meditate on nature. And I'm a positive psychology coach. I have clients. I help them find their careers and their sense of purpose in life. And I just came out with a new book, actually, called Pathways to Inner Peace. And one of the pathways is being back in touch with nature. So that's what I do.
What had you gravitating towards positive psychology and hope? That's a very interesting niche to be studying.
Well, I suppose it's because when I was in graduate school, I had two friends who were professors there, and I ended up doing research with one of them, Dave Feldman. In fact, we're giving a presentation on hope next month, actually, on campus. And we published an article on hope. I feel like people need to learn how to hope actively, not just wish for things to be better. Because sitting around wishing for things doesn't make a difference. But active hope involves setting a goal, you know. I'm going to grow a garden. And then pathways, steps to reach the goal. And then anticipating roadblocks. Well, what if this doesn't work? What else can I do? And then finally, a sense of agency. How to nurture our sense of possibility, our motivation. So goals, pathways, and agency. And Dave and I did this little research project on campus with some students, telling them about the difference between wishing and hoping, and asking them to write down a goal they wanted to achieve in the next few months, three steps to reach the goal, three roadblocks, one for each step that might come up, and then an alternative, what they could do instead. And then we led them through a visualization exercise that helped them develop motivation. Well, our little study has been recognized in over 500 other research projects throughout the world because it really works, you know, because when we set a goal and start moving toward it, taking one step at a time, that makes all the difference in the world. And what I'm concerned about lately is that a lot of people are sitting around doom scrolling on their phones, listening to the news, feeling hopeless and helpless. And what we need to do as human beings, our greatest capacity is our ability to create. Other animals can't do that, even though Jane Goodall discovered that animals could use tools. We human beings can create airplanes. We can fly. My father was a pilot. We can create great works of art. We can create gardens, and we can nurture new possibilities in our lives. But we need to take action. We need to have that kind of hope.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people who are listening are feeling extremely hopeless in this moment. So what would you say to someone listening who is really struggling with this concept of hope and how to even wrap their mind around being hopeful?
Wow, what a great question. I think that a lot of times when people feel hopeless and helpless, they feel totally isolated and alone, disconnected. And when we're disconnected, we feel distressed. We feel stressed. You know, we feel like, oh my gosh, you know, chronic stress shuts down our higher brain centers up here. We are limited to fight, flight, or freeze, survival reactions. And when you're crossing a street in a crosswalk and a car comes rushing by, which it shouldn't do, but they do from time to time, we jump out of the way. We don't stop and think, oh, what kind of car is that? What a beautiful color, or anything else. We just react. Okay, fight, flight, or freeze. In this case, it's flight to get out of the way. Sometimes we freeze. We just stand in place and let the car go by. And sometimes when people feel threatened, they fight. Well, these days, those three reactions don't help us solve our complex problems. They don't make us feel like we've got any sense of agency and motivation. So what we need to do first is to get ourselves out of chronic stress. And one way to do that is to go outside and connect with nature. I mean, there's research that shows that taking a brief walk in a natural setting can help relieve stress, relieve depression, and actually help us think more creatively. They had a study where college students were walking around inside the dorms and the buildings for 15 minutes, or another group would walk around for 15 minutes by a river. And then they came back and they did some tests and found out that one group of students was more relaxed, although, you know, exercise does help us relieve depression. And one group, the same group, was actually more creative, could come up with new possibilities. Just walking by or outside in nature for 15 minutes. So we need to get back in touch. We're disconnected from our source of inspiration and from our source of, in many cases, hope and possibility.
Yeah.
Poets have written for centuries about how inspired they get being out in nature. Wordsworth, Thoreau, Emerson, many, many others, because there's something out there that's part of who we are. We're part of nature. And when we forget that, we feel isolated and alone.
Yeah, I think it's interesting talking about how the real antidote to feeling hopeless is connection and finding connection again, because so many of us, as we doom scroll, pull into this moment of isolation in our own minds where we don't know what's right, what's wrong, what's real, what's fake. And then when we are able to be witnessed in that anxiety, in that hopelessness, it's alleviated. And so this idea of connection, but kind of across, you talk about connection beyond nature, but across many different kind of experiences. But nature is such a beautiful vehicle for connection because it does peel away. Like when you're in the forest, you're not on your phone. You don't feel isolated, even if you're alone in nature, because you're a part of the birds and the trees and all of it. And it just brings you back home. It brings you back to your natural nervous system setting and out of fight or flight.
Yeah. And again, people have noticed this. John Muir noticed it. Henry David Thoreau noticed it. But now psychologists and scientists have actually begun to measure it. And it's amazing. Just walking around in nature can help relieve depression.
Yeah. Isn't that wild? It's free.
Yeah.
You don't need to buy anything in order to do it. All you have to do is put your sneakers on or put your flip-flops on and go stand in your yard. Bonus points if you do it barefoot. In your book, it was interesting to read how much you've chronicled nature playing a role in history and wellness throughout history. Can you share a couple of the ways that our ancestors have been using nature therapeutically and how it's kind of evolved?
Well, nature, gosh, goes back at least 25 centuries to the Tao Te Ching in Eastern philosophy. And what I noticed, I have written three books on Taoism, that a long time ago in something called the Warring States period in ancient China, there were these two wise philosophers, Lao Tzu and Confucius. People respond to challenges in different ways. So Lao Tzu had his way. Confucius said, what we need to do in order to feel greater peace of mind is to follow these li, these rules, these kind of customs of honoring your elders and following, you know, polite customs and conforming. And Lao Tzu did just the opposite. He went walking out into nature and found consolation in the power of water, which is gentle and nurturing, yet with perseverance can cut through solid rock. Or the strength of bamboo, which I've noticed around here. We had some pretty severe storms a couple of years ago, and a lot of the big old trees fell down. Lao Tzu said, no, bamboo is strong because it's flexible. It bends with the wind and it does not break. So that we need the strength of flexibility, not just to be tough all the time, but to be flexible. And we need to persevere. So he found inspiration and consolation in the wisdom of nature. And the Tao Te Ching, this book of 81 lyric poems that he wrote about nature, has been published and translated and published more than any book in the world, with the exception of the Bible. Creative people have learned from Lao Tzu. Carl Rogers, the noted psychologist, used to carry a quote from Lao Tzu from the Tao Te Ching in his wallet about leadership, which again is a different kind of leadership than what some people seem to believe. The leader needs to be a dictator. No, according to the Tao, when the work is done, the project completed, the people all say we did it ourselves. That's the quote that Carl Rogers carried with him, because he realized that no one person knows all of it, and that we are all part of something larger than ourselves. we're part of this universe, part of nature.
I love that.
So there's that. Okay. There's also, there are studies of, oh gosh, forest bathing in Japan more recently.
Mm-hmm.
Like a few years ago, a group of scientists went to Japan and they had people just sit in a forest and look around for 15 minutes and then walk around for another 15 minutes. And these people, their inflammation was reduced, their stress was relieved, and they felt more at peace, you know, again, in a half an hour. I mean, we can waste a half an hour, you know, like that, scrolling on our phones.
Imagine growing a garden that involves no buying transplants, no starting seeds, no yearly planting, and no seed buying. And there's no real off season. Imagine if you could have a productive vegetable garden and that be your experience every year. That is the quiet magic behind this new book that just came out called The Continuous Vegetable Garden by Charlie Nardozzi. Instead of the annual hustle, Charlie teaches us how to design a garden that actually reseeds itself. It does the work for itself. It relies on dependable perennials and keeps producing season after season. It's the most low-maintenance way you can grow food for you and your family. In the book, Charlie walks you through self-sowing vegetables, long-lived perennial crops, and simple ways to protect plants so your garden can keep producing longer. You'll also learn how to save seeds, plan for continuous harvests in small or large spaces, and set things up right from the start, your soil, your location, and everything, so it just becomes a gift that keeps on giving season after season after season. The Continuous Vegetable Garden is proof that you can really grow more food with less work. And honestly, who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want a more productive vegetable garden with less work? So if you're interested, you can grab the new book, The Continuous Vegetable Garden by Charlie Nardozzi, wherever books are sold. Support your local bookstores when you can. Once again, that's called The Continuous Vegetable Garden by Charlie Nardozzi, and start building a garden that keeps showing up for you.
And that is an artificial means of connection. A lot of advertisers want to capture our attention. You know, they want to assault us with their ads. They want to take us away from our natural connection to one another and to the natural world. But my favorite experiment, if you will, or evidence of the power of nature happened in a Philadelphia hospital many years ago, where patients were recovering from abdominal surgery.
Yeah, this is a great study.
And they had the same surgery, the same doctors, the same nurses, the same hospital food, et cetera. The only difference was some of the patients looked out at a view of trees outside their windows, and another group looked out at bare brick walls. So one group needed less pain medication, suffered fewer complications, and were discharged earlier than the others.
Mm-hmm.
The people that looked out at trees found connection and hope, and their immune systems worked better.
How wild. There's a great book called Forest Bathing by Dr. King Lee. He's like one of the predominant forest medicine researchers in Japan. And he talks about how like, it increases the cancer-killing cells in your body. Like if you spend enough time breathing in the forest medicine, or even they did a study like diffusing hinoki oil at night for people just to sleep with this essential oil and all of the benefits. I mean, it's so wild, but also what I find so interesting is it makes so much sense. Yet our society now needs all of these studies to prove something that like, should be pretty intuitive to us. You know, our ancestors grew up in nature. We were exposed to nature. We are nature. Of course, we're going to heal better, feel more calm when we're surrounded by ourselves, which is nature. Yet now it's like this novel idea to be around plants. I find it so interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I guess our human ability to create or concoct things has surrounded us with machines.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of my students, when they're tired, they say, I need to reboot. Like, what? You're not a computer. You're not a machine. Maybe you need to rest. But, you know, again, if our paradigm, if we see ourselves in a mechanistic way and don't see the whole inclusive pattern, but we're not very wise. And our ancestors knew this. Some of my ancestors are Native Americans, and they knew this quite well. You know, Chief Seattle said, whatever we do to nature, we do to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, and talk about a community that understands the importance of living in reverence and in reciprocity for nature, who we've totally silenced like over the years. You know, it's so interesting. The more like Native American indigenous texts I read, it's like, yeah, it is the more than human world. Yes, like stones, the Stone Nation is a thing. And you know, all of this makes it just, it makes so much sense to me. So your book, The Pathways to Inner Peace, what brought you to write this book?
Well, I noticed that a lot of us are feeling disconnected, more so after COVID, but mm-hmm. even before that. Mm-hmm. Our former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said that there was an epidemic of loneliness and isolation in this country. Interestingly enough, and other studies have shown that college students, the group that I spent many, many years relating to on a very personal basis, they became very stressed, anxious, and depressed when they started using smartphones. Mm-hmm. I call them cell phones. I don't think they're really smart. I think only humans can be smart.
But yeah.
When they started doing that, and I would see my students walking from one class to the next on our beautiful campus.
Yep.
Santa Clara University, it was founded by the Franciscans as a mission. We have these mission gardens with wisteria vines that are, you know, wider than my body. They're incredibly old. I don't know how old these vines are, but every year they bloom. We have roses. We have this gorgeous campus. Students are walking around looking at their phones. They weren't looking at people. They aren't looking at nature.
And 100%.
We're becoming a race of cyborgs, you know, humans that are connected to machines. Connection to machines disconnects us from ourselves in a deeper mm-hmm. sense, from our world, from nature, and from one another. So I figured, all right, we're disconnected. What do we need? Pathways to inner peace are 9 pathways that have been practiced by through centuries of spiritual tradition from our ancestors who knew better in many ways, okay, mm-hmm. and celebrated by poets and philosophers, and are now validated by recent research in psychology and neuroscience, that connecting with nature, connecting with other people, even if it's just waving at a neighbor, what that does, these micro moments of connectivity, as psychologist Barbara Fredrickson says, that relieves stress, activates our immune system, makes us feel peaceful, connected, and a sense of happiness, a sense of hope, just, you know, in as many seconds as it takes to wave at somebody or exchange a kind word with the grocery store clerk. Or, you know, anyone.
But you have to take your face out of your phone in order to see the neighbor, to see the grocery clerk. You know, you have to. And this is now a habit that we need to actively break. My husband and I talk about this all the time. 2 things. Number one, we met each other when we were 15. And then when we were 25. Yeah, when we were 25, we were both living in New York City. We didn't know we both lived in New York City. And we were walking past each other on the street, and I was on the phone with my mom. So I was not paying attention. Thank goodness he was off of his phone, saw me, recognized me, stopped me. If we were both on our phones in that moment, we would have passed each other, never reconnected, and never had the incredible marriage that we have. And we've been together for 14 years and, you know, all of that. So I think that's an interesting, just like, wake up people story, but also like, we both struggle with screen addiction. I think every person does. And my husband just bought the Brick, which is like a product that you can, it basically locks you out of your phone. And he's breaking his phone every night when he comes home so that he can actively physically break this. It's like a physical addiction as much as it's a mental addiction in, you don't realize how much your hand goes to grab your phone unconsciously until you lock yourself out of your phone. And then all of a sudden you're noticing how many times you go to grab your phone and you didn't even realize it. So it's a deep thing now that I feel like as a society, we've dug ourselves pretty deep in a trench of this screen dependency that now we have to dig ourselves out of in a way that like is kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, well, what a beautiful story. I'm glad he was not using his phone.
I know. Very glad. Very glad.
But I must apologize. I live in California's Silicon Valley, which created these addictive things.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is they're using intermittent reinforcement, which is the strongest form of reinforcement. You can give an animal a treat every time it pushes a lever, and okay, it will push the lever. But if you give it a treat occasionally, it becomes really obsessively committed to pushing the lever because maybe next time this will, I'll get a jackpot. Mm. And that's what happens with gambling addiction. You don't get the reward every time. It's this intermittent thing. So it keeps us thinking, what's on it? You know, the suspense, this kind of compulsive behavior. And they know what they're doing because a lot of the Silicon Valley CEOs will not let their children.
I know.
Use things.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. So again, back to hope, goals, pathways, and agency. Our sense of agency, our motivation, our attention is a very valuable part of our experience. It's everything we are. It's what we pay attention to. That's what connects us to that experience. Mm-hmm. If we're not paying attention to it, it might as well not be there. And what we pay attention to gets stronger. So, for example, my father grew up on a farm in Kentucky during the Depression. Really poor. They didn't have indoor plumbing. I mean, figure that one out. And his mother wanted him to be a priest. He was an only child and she was a very devout Catholic. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. He was out working in the fields and he saw a little airplane fly by. And his attention was captured by this sense of freedom. So he ran to the airport, helped the pilot tie down the plane, and he could get a quarter during the Depression for helping tie down a plane. And that was a lot of money back then. But he kept going back, because his attention was inspired by this sense of freedom. And his mother nagged him and got very bad at home. When he was 15, he moved away from home into the attic of the Louisville Flying Service and continued to go to high school. And then when he was finished with school, he would help the pilots wash the plane and tie them down. And they took him up from time to time and he learned to fly. And got his pilot's license at age 16 and was featured on the front page of the Louisville Courier-Journal as the youngest pilot in Kentucky.
Wow, that's so cool. Your dad is so cool.
Yeah, because he saw that. That was his goal. That was his attention. That was who he was. And that's who he became. He became, obviously, a pilot, an Air Force pilot, and lived until he was 99, actually, because he had a sense of joy and purpose. But what we give our attention to, you know, that's what really becomes part of our identity. And these people who've invented these addictive devices are capturing our attention and keeping us hostage to their monetary greed, I think.
Truly, where attention goes, energy flows.
Yep.
I love that phrase. So it's interesting, the story about your dad brought up another thing that I'm noticing. The more I look into this nature, human connection, the more I learn about the nervous system, this nature connection and nature as wellness is tethered to this concept of awe and how much awe can really inform the nervous system, particularly when it comes to joy. And you speak a lot about awe in your book. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think we've all experienced a sense of awe.
Yeah.
My father certainly did when he was in a plane. He used to pick me up. We'd fly through the clouds, you know, and it's being aware of something that's larger than ourselves. That's a sense of beauty. It's a connection to the divine, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
It's a sense of inspiration, which is why poets have written about Nietzsche for centuries, is because they felt this sense of connection with, you know, this, what Emerson called the oversoul, the great, you know, the great spirit, as Native American ancestors would call it. It's a sense of losing our ego and expanding our sense of who we are and who we might be, because we're part of something larger than ourselves. And all of the inner critic, you know, worries, frustrations, stress absolutely disappears when we become part of that larger sense of a possibility in awe. We can feel it looking at great works of art, you know, which expand our sense of possibility. And Dr. Keltner, who does research on awe, wrote a book called Awe, actually, is a psychologist in San Francisco. He and his brother used to go walking in nature. And, you know, that was one of the things that they loved to do. And he still loves being in nature and writes about it very eloquently. But his brother passed away a couple of years ago. And yet, when Dacher is out there in nature. He feels at one with nature, but he also feels his brother walking beside him, because it's not rational. It's something that's transcendent that we experience when we experience awe.
Yeah, it connects you to your loved ones, the dead, your ancestors in such a unique way. Because if you think about it, I read this book on the moon once, and one of the opening lines was like, thousands of years ago, someone looked up at the moon yearning the way you've looked up at the moon yearning one day. Like, that's such a human experience that the moon is the only one to have witnessed, you know, over these centuries that humans have been alive. And it's similar, but like all of those experiences happen in nature, like that are written about. And awe, I would feel, is probably tethered to hope as well, because when you can be in awe of something, that's probably a very similar area of your heart that is connected to hope.
It's beautiful. And a sense of awe, again, makes us see beyond our current limitations. You know, I've never done that before. I can't do this, etc. I was like my father. How could he have believed? He must have experienced awe when he looked up and saw that airplane flying above him. How could he have managed to think, there's no way I could afford flying lessons? I am a poor boy living on the farm. I will never go any further than right here. And a lot of us are stuck in the situation, the status quo. And we don't believe in our dreams. And a sense of awe opens us up to embrace our dreams. And that's what we need, you know? That's what we need as individuals, but that's what we need as countries, as neighborhoods. We need to believe that there's more out there. And there's more in our hearts, in our own lives than we've ever experienced before. And that's hope.
That's hope. I love that. So if listeners are feeling inspired by this conversation, what are some of the, so you have 9 pathways in your book, Nature is One Pathway. Like, what are some practices that you would suggest for people to go out and connect with awe, experience connection, you know, do all of the things we've been talking about? What are some easy ways people can do that?
Well, one way is to be present. Right here and right now in the present moment, which is what being out in nature, we usually are not distracted by our to-do lists or thinking what we need to buy at the grocery store. We are present. We are watching a sunset. We are one with the birds and the trees, you know, we listen to the music. So mindful presence is the very first pathway. And one of the difficulties is, of course, that most of us spend 50% of our time doing one thing and thinking about something else.
Yep.
That's what we've been trained to do by our busy, noisy, mechanistic culture. So we need to take our attention back. And one way to do that is simply breathing, to take a deep, mindful breath. I learned this from a Stanford neurosurgeon, Jim Doty, who said he would take 3 deep mindful breaths in the midst of complex brain surgery so he could center down, be fully present, and do what he needed to do to stop. At one point, a young boy's brain, it was bleeding, and somehow Jim Doty needed to go in there, stop the bleeding, continue the operation. And where a lot of people get very stressed and freaked out and get into fight, flight, or freeze, which would not help him do the operation, he would just take 3 deep mindful breaths and then go back and do this. He founded the Center for Compassion at Stanford with the Dalai Lama, who obviously believes in the importance of being totally present, to be present in a relationship, not to be. I've seen couples at a lovely restaurant at dinner gazing at their phones.
Yeah.
Both of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, if one of them is a doctor and he needs to check his messages and this is urgent, okay. But no, this was just, you know, again, it's that addictive habit. So to take our attention back, to be present, to when we feel ourselves getting scattered and stressed, to just take 3 deep mindful breaths and come back to the here and now. First thing. Second, nature. Well, I see that you do have plants in you. And behind you, this room, I don't have plants, but I do have a view of trees outside my window, which, again, experiments have shown it's good for our immune system. And I have plants in other rooms in my house. Adopt a plant, you know, nurture it. If we don't have room for a garden, if we live in an apartment, well, okay, we probably have windows.
Fingers crossed, yeah.
And a windowsill, and a sunny windowsill, you can put a plant there. Some of my friends like to keep herbs growing in their kitchen windowsill so they can pinch off a little bit when they're cooking, which again is cooperation with nature. You know, there's something really nice in having fresh basil instead of something that comes in a jar.
Totally.
I have rosemary plants. Actually, they're growing outside, which I have to keep cutting back because they're flourishing so much. They're going to be as tall as I am if I don't do anything about it. But it's wonderful to cook with rosemary. You can just, you know, have chicken and have a couple of rosemary sprigs. So do things that put us in touch with nature, take a walk, you know, around the neighborhood or in a local park or something. Make use of, renew our relationship with nature. We need that. Again, we don't have to do huge things. You don't have to have a garden, but, you know, have a little plant. I love it. I have plants growing up in my upstairs bathroom near the shower. They love that because they get humidity as well as light. And whenever there's a new leaf growing on one of my philodendron plants, it makes me happy. I think, oh, look, what does that mean? That I get happy looking at a new leaf. It's because there's a sense of connection and renewal that I feel emotionally and physically when I look at that plant. So adopt a plant.
I love that. Yeah, I think too, when you see new growth, it's like empowering because it's your plant and you're the caretaker. So, you know, you feel like, oh, wow, what I'm doing is working and I feel so good that it's growing. But also, if you go back to the biophilia hypothesis, like if we're all living things and if we're attracted to other living things and we see this other living thing growing, it's almost a mirror back to us of, yeah, well, we could be growing too, or we're growing too, and maybe we don't notice it, but the plant gets to show it to us.
Yeah, in that case, the plant is like a living poem, you know, a metaphor for life.
Yeah,
absolutely. And besides, they breathe out what we breathe in, you know. There's an exchange of carbon dioxide and oxygen that goes on, breathing in and breathing out, a cycle. And if we don't have enough plants around us, well, our air is not the kind of air that we need.
Talk about collaboration, right? Like, that's the ultimate collaboration, us and all the trees and plants.
Right. Which is why it feels so good to walk in the woods, because, you know, you can smell. Well, it's like almost like incense, you know, this beautiful, fragrant redwood in my neighborhood feeling. But also it's the air is so fresh because the plants have been freshening it for us, you know, wonderful trees. Another pathway is community. Again, the couple that sits at a lovely restaurant, you know, having a romantic interlude with their phones instead of each other. That's the opposite of what we need. And there's again, Barbara Fredrickson, the micro moments of connectivity, the fact that we can reach out and just connect with somebody, or just say hi, just wave. That's all it takes. And it's good for us, but it also spreads in a ripple effect, can spread throughout an entire community, which is what we need now, because a lot of people are feeling isolated and alone and disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And meditation is another one, obviously, of connecting with the source, with a sense of peace. Kindness, practicing compassion for ourselves and others.
Mm-hmm.
Most human beings that I know, at least all of my clients and friends, have something called an inner critic, which says we say things to ourselves that are really not very nurturing, that don't really reinforce us for agency and motivation, that tell us, you've never done this before. Well, who do you think you are? You're going to screw this one up, I'm sure, or whatever it is. If I said things to my friends that I have said to myself in my inner critic voice, I would not have any friends.
Yep, 100%.
It's very insulting. So what can we do but practice self-compassion, as psychologist Kristen Neff and my friend Shauna Shapiro, another psychologist, talk about, you know, to just pause when you feel that inner critic coming at you. Take a deep breath and say, okay, I'm feeling stressed. What am I feeling? Stressed, anxious, nervous, worried, whatever. Because to say, whether it's out loud or to ourselves, what we're feeling changes, shifts the attention in our brains from the amygdala, which is the brain's alarm center, to the Wernicke's and Broca's areas, the verbal centers in our brain, so that we immediately shift out of that self-accusing thing. And then we can say, you know, it's only human to feel this way. And then say, okay, say something that you'd say to a friend. It's okay. I'm here for you. We'll get through this, you know. And Kristen says you can even give yourself a hug by squeezing your shoulders, saying, I'm here for you.
So I love that.
Self-compassion, kindness, a sense of purpose. A lot of people are feeling disconnected because they don't have a sense of purpose beyond getting up and going to work, maybe to a job that they can't really relate to, but, you know, they've got to pay the bills, doing things on their to-do list, you know. And we're all here for a purpose. We all, I believe, have something intrinsically valuable to share. And we can connect with a sense of purpose. In fact, there's research that shows that I was just reading this morning that when people retire, a lot of people lose their sense of purpose because, you know, they're not going to work anymore. And that's not good for our health. So people who have a sense of purpose are healthier, happier, and more successful, according to research in positive psychology. And they also, in the second half of life, their brains stay healthier when they have a sense of purpose. Otherwise, what do people do? You know, they get up, they eat breakfast, they watch TV, they scroll through the phone, and they, you know, they do their laundry. And I mean, this is not inspiring. Go out and plant a tree and give you a sense of purpose. Watch it grow. So then there's intuition, connecting with inspiration and inner guidance. I believe we all have that. I have discovered it many times for myself that when it looks like, you know, you're stuck, If we can go out and disconnect from that feeling of chronic stress, limitation, stuck, listen to our hearts, amazing things can happen. Parents, I was a first generation college student. I was graduated from Kaiserslautern American High School in Germany after going to 10 different schools before I graduated from high school because my father kept getting transferred. Okay. And I wanted to go to UCLA. It was my dream school. So I applied and got accepted and was very excited. We moved back to California for my father's next assignment at Norton Air Force Base, which is in Southern California near Riverside. We moved back in the summer. At the end of August, I was in this bedroom in my parents' suburban house, taking clothes out and deciding what I was going to pack to take to UCLA. My mother came into the room and said, "What are you doing? I'm getting ready to go to UCLA. I'm deciding what to take." She said, "Oh, well, your father and I have discussed this, and we transferred your acceptance to UC Riverside, so you don't have to go away to college." And I said, "What? I wanted to go. It wasn't a have to. I wanted to. I was ready to, as my father would say, to solo, to fly on my own." But my mother had other ideas. And I said, "Well, why?" And she said, "Well, we can't afford it." And then she left the room. And I thought, can't go to UCLA and my parents are having financial problems. Boy, this is bad. And this was kind of strange because my father was a colonel and he, you know, had pretty good salary. And then that Christmas, my mother got a new mink coat and a Mercedes for Christmas. So I figured it was not money. It was something else. And if I wanted to go away and have a college experience, live in the dorms, et cetera, I needed to figure that one out for myself. So that summer, I got these little part-time jobs and was driving this old red Volkswagen that I shared with my brother down 14th Street in Riverside. And I went by the Riverside Press Enterprise, which was our local newspaper. And this feeling came over me that said, "Diane, if you're a writer, you should work there." So I did a U-turn, went into the parking lot, walked into the newsroom as a shy teenager and said, "Hi, I'm Diane Dreher. I'm a writer. I'd like to apply for a job." And he said, "Go upstairs to the personnel office." And I did, filled out some papers. And they said, "Our college intern just gave notice this morning. Can you start work on Monday?"
Wow.
Well, it was perfect. 20 hours a week, I could work around my class schedule. And it was enough to pay for my tuition, room and board in the dorms, all my books, everything. So I declared my independence, worked for the newspaper. And not only that, but it was great because I learned from all these dedicated journalists what it means to be a writer. They helped me. They were role models. And I majored in English. And my professor, I took this class. My friends told me not to take it because he was a hard grader. But I had already enrolled because I was working at the newspaper and before registration. Ended up loving this Renaissance literature class so much that I go in and talk to the professor and say, this poet said this and such, and I'd read extra stuff. And he said, do you want to be my research assistant? I'll pay you and you can go. So I kind of work at the newspaper. I got paid for reading this inspiring poetry. And he wrote me a letter of recommendation because he had gone to UCLA for his PhD. And I got a full graduate fellowship to the PhD program at UCLA. Was that an accident? Or was that all part of listening to my heart?
And right.
not just settling for the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Pulling the U-turn, yeah.
Positive psychology affirms our ability to grow. They call it a growth mindset.
Yeah.
We can have a growth mindset or a fixed mindset where we're stuck the way we are. No, we're not. Human beings have the ability to grow and flourish, and we need to connect with that.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, where can people find your book and learn more about you? Because you have such interesting takes, and obviously you feature nature a lot, but the interesting thing I'm hearing, too, is all of the other pathways that you talk about are easily applied to nature, you know, community.
Yes.
Intuition, you know, all of these pathways, like you can easily experience with your plants and in nature, too. So where can people find you and learn more about you?
Okay, well, I do have a website, which is dianedreher.com, dianedreher. And my books are there. There are meditations. There are all kinds of clues about how we can be more connected, how we can be more at peace with ourselves. And all my books are available online or at your local bookstore. Pathways to Inner Peace just came out. So it's available at barnesandnoble.com, at amazon.com, and bookstores can order it.
Great. We'll link to everything in the show notes. And thank you so much. This was a really inspiring conversation.
Well, thank you, Maria. And I'm so glad that you and your husband connected personally and not
off of our phones, baby, off of our phones.
That is such a beautiful, inspiring story.
Yeah. I mean, tell it. You can use it when you're on other podcasts. Yeah.
We need to connect really, totally, personally with nature, one another, and a deeper sense of ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, plant friends, this conversation really did feel like an invitation to slow down, to notice what's growing around you, to remember that hope isn't something we wait for, it's something we practice. I was out for a walk today and I did the first loop of my walk on the phone with a friend and then she hung up. And the second loop of the walk, I went to play a podcast and then I thought, you know what? No, I'm just gonna walk and enjoy the bird song and whatever natural noises were coming up. And in the second loop of that walk, I really noticed how much easier it was for me to smell the scents of the trees that were coming off of the trees on my walk and enjoy the crackle of the leaves that were crunching under my feet and the different textures under my feet. I got to really tune in and watch the birds diving for fish in the water near me. It was a completely different present experience that really inspired awe that me and Diane talked about. So I highly recommend it. If you want more support in addition to this, obviously, Diane's resources are in the show notes, including her book. And also, I highly encourage you and invite you to join us for part two of Growing Joy in 2026, a community live experience where we are going to figure out how to use nature to live our most joyful life yet. That will also be linked in the show notes for you. And until next time, my sweet plant friends, keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test.
It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media on Instagram and TikTok. I'm growing joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.